history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell if you just take the time to listen. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And it's a pretty unique story we'll hear today from 94-year-old Mel Pliner of Las Vegas, Nevada, but originally from the Big Apple. You grew up in Brooklyn. What was that like?
Right. Well, just like any other kid that grew up in Brooklyn, I went to school at PS 135, public school. Played the usual games, soccer, fixed a roller skate, made me a little cart that I put a apple crate on, and played light touch football from a roll of toilet tissue that we stole from Berkowitz's grocery store. Just the usual kid things that you do when you're growing up.
Do you remember as a boy what your ambitions were? What kind of hopes and dreams or ideas you had about what you were going to be doing in your life?
Well, let me put it this way. My dad was in the steamship laundry business. He had contracts with different steamship companies. And then when their ships would come in from wherever they had been before, he would go aboard and gather the laundry, tablecloths, napkins, cruise laundry, stuff like that. And he would take it to a laundry, having it processed, and then he would get it back to the ship, present the bill to the steward. Steward would take the captain. He would sign it, give him the bill. My dad would take it to the company in town, and they would write him a check. One of the ships that contracts that he had with the Ford Motor Company, and they had a steamship which actually was diesel operated, it wasn't steam anymore, named the East Indian. And he got me a job on board the East Indian as the officer's mess boy. At the time I was 17 years old. We left New York Harbor and went across the grader down to Buenos Aires, Argentina. When we got down there, we unloaded auto parts for an assembly company that they had down there that assembled Ford automobiles. After we unloaded the parts, we took on a load of beans, soybeans. After that, when I got back to Brooklyn, I also had the opportunity when I was 17, 18, and 19 to join what was called the CMTC, Citizens Military Training Corps.
Right.
Which, for 2 weeks during the summer months, I could get out of the hot, humid city, and I would go upstate New York, 10 Mile River, to a military camp where they trained us in field artillery. We never did fire the 75 millimeters, but we did have 57 millimeter guns mounted on the barrel, which we trained with. They gave us uniforms. We learned how to march, carry a gun, and all that military stuff.
Right.
Did that for 2 weeks out of the year, three times, 17, 18, when I was 19.
And 19 is how old you were in March of 1941 when you decided to enlist in the military. But when they told you it was a six-year commitment, that wasn't what you had in mind.
So I went across the hall to the U.S. Army Air Corps, and I asked him, the guy in charge there, how long is your enlistment? He said, duration and 6 months. I said, sign me up. That's how I got into the U.S. Army Air Corps. It wasn't U.S. Army Air Force yet.
Right.
Okay.
So that's a gamble on your part, because you're saying, if there is a war, I hope it's shorter than 6 years.
Well, if there was going to be a war, I'd be in the Air Force. But I wasn't going to be in the field artillery.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. I signed up on a Tuesday, got my orders on a Wednesday. On Thursday, I was on my way to Camp Dix, New Jersey, across the river. There, I got my uniform, and they started to teach us how to march, carry a rifle, and so forth, which I knew how to do from my CMTC.
Sure.
Okay, after 6 weeks of that, they sent me down to Lawson Field, Fort Benning, Georgia. Of course, now back then, I won't say everybody smoked, but most people, young men, smoked.
Sure.
And when I got down there, I gave my orders to the lieutenant in charge, sat down, was smoking a cigarette. And he said, what did you do during civilian life? Well, I said, my dad had a laundry business, and I drove a laundry truck. Actually, though, Dad didn't have a laundry truck. What he had was an old LaSalle.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of a LaSalle?
I've seen them, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, they were comparable to Cadillacs.
Right.
But this was a 7-passenger car. He took the back seat and the seat out, and it had 2 jump seats that folded in to the back of the front seat.
All right.
And this is where he would put the bags of laundry. And if all the bags didn't fit inside, he put them on the roof and tie them on the roof. This is what he had. When we were going to go somewhere as the family, then we'd open up the jump seat, and us 3 kids would get in the back, and Mom would get in the front.
Makes sense.
That was Dad's truck. And this is what we drove.
Right.
And I learned, when I was 15 years old, I learned how to drive on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Stick shift.
Of course.
What'd you do in the civilian? I said, laundry truck. Sent me down to the motor pool. I got down to the motor pool, and all it was a big open field with grass and weeds and stuff, and a shack on it about 3 times the size of a telephone booth. And in there was a buck sergeant. I forget his name. He was an Irishman. I came in there and told him, hey, I'm assigned down to the motor pool. We sat down, smoked a cigarette, talked a while. Outside was 2 pieces of equipment, a maintainer and a steamroller, but it was diesel operated.
All right.
We're sitting there, and he says to me, Pliny, he says, can you handle that equipment? I said, no sweat, Sarge. Here, I'm a city kid. I never saw him before. But I figured if anybody could operate him, hell, I could.
Uh-huh.
So I got out there, and I looked at it, and here's this big 4-cylinder diesel engine. Mm-hmm. In the back of the vehicle of this maintainer, and it's got a little donkey engine to start it because it wasn't a self-start. See a button, and I pushed a button that says start, but no smoke's coming out of the stack. So I look around. He has a little gas can with a valve on it. Open the valve up, hit the start button, and the little donkey engine started up. Now, here's 2 big, great big levers. Doesn't say what they do. I pull this one lever. That's grinding gears. Pulled on, this is the clutch, and this is the gear. And I release it, and it starts to turn over this big cylinder engine. No smoke's coming out of the stack. Reach around there somewhere, find a valve, open the valve, up comes it, starts the engine. So I shut the little donkey engine down. By that time, I get up into the cab, and here's 7 big little levers. Doesn't say what they do. I just look over there, and I pull a lever to see what it does. At least that one, pull this lever, see what it does. Pretty soon, I got out into the middle of the field, and I started to scrape off the grass and the weeds. And I was starting to make the field look like that.
Putting some furrows in it unintentionally.
I got the grass and the stuff grewed off. Shortly after that, about 4 or 5 dump trucks with gravel show up. Hey, kid, where do you want the gravel? I said, just dump it anywhere. I'll level it up, which I did pretty good.
Flying blind on all of this.
Yeah. After I got the gravel leveled, the following morning I came down, they were the concrete bumpers for the trucks to come up to. When I got down there, this sergeant in charge says, and there was 3 other guys down there. He said, since you were working here yesterday, he says, you pick out the 2 runs that you want. So I picked out the morning bread run and the afternoon ice run.
Hmm.
And I went outside and I picked the truck, 6x6 truck, 0940810. I still remember the number on the hood of the truck. I got in the 6x6 and I went up to the supply place and I said I need a couple of mattress covers to put in the bed of the truck. So that I can put the bread on.
Right.
Because they don't want to put it on the dirty,
sure.
On the floor. I backed up to the bakery, and I talked to the guy in charge. I said, I got the bread run. He says, okay, how many sheaves do you want? Now, bread isn't baked in individual. They baked 6 loaves of bread to 1 sheave.
All right.
about that wide,
yeah.
Six loaves. How many sheaves you want? I said, oh, give me 10 sheaves, 5 mess holes. Now, this is strictly for enlisted men, not for for officers.
Okay.
Officers have a separate.
Right.
Okay. I went to the first mess hall, and I talked to the guy. I says, hey, send your KP guys out because I've got some bread. How many sheaves do you want? He said, oh, about 1.5. So I went to the other 4. When I finally wound up, I had a sheave left over, 6 loaves of bread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what am I going to do with it? I went to the PX. I walked into the PX, and I said, who's in charge here? He said, Mr. So-and-so. I walked over to him, so I said, Mr. So-and-so, I've got the bread wrong, and I got a sheave left over with 6 loaves of bread. Can you use it? He said, yeah, bring it in, son. So I brought in the sheaves of bread. He said, incidentally, he says, would you like something? A soda or something? I said, yeah, I'll have a soda. He says, anything you want, you've got it. It's on the house. Great. By that time, it was lunchtime. So I went to lunch. I got back out of my truck, and I went over to the ice house. Now, ice comes in 300-pound blocks.
Yikes.
I went to the supply store, and I got me a pair of ice tongs and an ice pick. I backed up to the ice house, told the guy, I got the ice run. How many blocks do you want? I figured, I don't know, take 9 blocks, 3, 6, 9 in my truck. Went back to the mess halls. I said, I got the ice. Now, I had to cut the blocks up into 50-pound blocks, 6 50-pound blocks.
Right.
So I gave the guys on KP my ice tongs, said, hey, take them in. And they put them in the freezers of the mess halls. I wound up with a block of ice. Back to the PX.
Uh-huh.
Mr. So-and-so, can you use some ice? He says, yeah, kid. How much you got? I said, I got 6 blocks. He said, bring them in, put them in the freezer, which I did. What would you like? Well, I did that for about 6 months. And after 6 months, I decided to transfer over to the 82nd Materiel Squadron, fixing airplanes, because I was pretty good with my hands. Well, shortly after I transferred over to the 82nd Materiel Squadron, the squadron was then transferred over to an air base near Albany, Georgia, on the other side of Georgia, because we were stationed right on the border line between Georgia and Alabama.
All right.
Also, the thing is that when I was down there, I had a little car that I had bought that I drove down in. In order for me to get gas, I would take my 6x down to the river, and one of the guys would drive my car down, and I got me some.
You'd siphon the gas out of the truck?
Get some gasoline, yeah. We did that for a while. They never knew about it.
Uh-huh.
Nobody could. Anyway, we transferred over to an air base just outside of Albany, Georgia. And it wasn't long after that, about the first part of 1942, I was in 82nd Squadron, Materiel Squadron, fixing airplanes. I was pretty good with doping fabric and sheet metal, riveting, and that sort of thing.
Let me ask you something before we go on, since you said that's 42. I got to ask you about a date in 41, because it seems like everybody remembers something about that day, December 7th. Where were you? How did you find out that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
In December of 41, I was still stationed in Laurinburg, Maxon, North Carolina. And a couple of other guys, myself, were taking a trip over to the big city. And on our way back is when we heard about Pearl Harbor. And it was shortly after that, something come out, all military personnel report to the base.
Right.
Their base. That's when I heard about it.
Was it a big deal? Was it a shock? Did you realize what
had
happened?
We didn't know what it was all about till we got back to base, and then we found out what it was. That was on a Sunday.
Yep.
Monday, Roosevelt got on the radio and declared war.
And you heard that speech there at the base?
Oh, yeah. Well, we all heard that.
Did it fire you up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We figured we're in a war now.
So then you're at the new base. You're working with the 82nd Squadron. What kind of planes were you working on?
Well, back then they had aircraft with fabric covered that had puddle jumpers,
yeah.
Reconnaissance aircraft, Veronicas, Taylor Craft, Piper Cubs. These were all metal framed covered with fabric. And I got pretty good with the dope and fabric. Pull it up, stretch it, and then sew it. And then you'd put strips over the sewing. Then you'd cover it with some dope on it. the dope would dry up and it would make the fabric like a drum.
Yeah, firm it up. But as you're working on airplanes, you're also thinking, you know, I'd kind of like to fly airplanes?
About July, the squadron was transferring over to North Africa in preparation for the invasion of Sicily. And I was being left behind because I was a pretty good scrounger. And I was being left behind with a couple of other guys to start a new squadron. And I figured if I can't go with my outfit, I'll find my own way. So I went to officer's flight school.
All right.
And I said, I'd like to sign up for flight school, learn how to fly airplane. He said, we got a list as long as your arm. I said, well, okay, if I can't go to flight school, I'll go to officer's candidate school. Got there, they said, we got a list longer than your arm. I started back to flight school. When I got there, they had received a TWIX telegram looking for volunteers for the glider program. I said, sign me up. This was August of 1942. After I got my papers and so forth, I was sent to Pittsburgh, Kansas State Teachers College, where the college had a small little airport and had a contract with the Air Corps to teach us how to fly airplanes. And there were eight of us in the class. During the summer months, we were put up in, they didn't have barracks, but I guess they took over one of the fraternity house for us to sleep in. And we ate meals in the cafeteria. We learned how to fly these puddle jumpers, tail draggers. I got pretty good at it, and I soloed with 7 hours and 45 minutes. I was the first one to solo. And consequently, I had to buy the class when we went to town a round of beers. And beer was a nickel a glass, which I did. From Pittsburgh, Kansas, I was sent to Lubbock, Texas, South Plains Army Flying School, where they had the high-performance sailplanes. Now, have you been to the museum?
I have.
Remember the big sailplanes, high-performance sailplanes hanging up there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you also saw the puddle jumpers. They got a puddle jumper there.
Yeah, you're talking about the Silent Wings Museum in Lubbock, Texas.
Right.
Which is where you trained, what you're talking about right now.
Okay, well, if you were there, then you saw the puddle jumpers. You saw the high-performance sailplanes hanging from the ceiling. The idea was take off and get on tow, which was real simple. Once you get off tow, you got one shot at a landing. It's got to be a good one. You can't give it the gas. Go around again.
Well, and let's make sure everybody gets that, because when you said you volunteered for the glider program, I mean, they told you there weren't going to be any engines in these planes, right?
Well, I knew what gliders were.
Because, I mean, if you tell me you're going to fly an airplane, but you've got no power, no guns, no defenses, and you've got to land that, and you get one shot at it. I don't know if I'd be jumping at that chance. I mean, this is pretty dangerous work.
Well, at that time, my outfit went overseas, left me behind. I figured this might be one way.
You didn't want to miss out.
No, I didn't. I figured my country's in the war now. Mm-hmm. That's the least I can do.
And maybe you understood this right from the get-go, but some folks at home, believe it or not, there are a lot of people that don't even know we had gliders in World War II and what they did and the different uses that there were for them. For someone who's uninitiated to the glider program, explain what the idea was and how these gliders were going to be used in combat.
That I'll get along to that. That comes on after I get into it.
Well, you started talking about the towing, so I just wanted to make sure they understood. There's a plane that has to tow you into the air, and then you take it from there.
All right, I'll tell you. The idea behind the gliders were, and the Germans had been doing this prior to our country realizing what the gliders had done for the German troops. Mm. So they decided to get into the glider program. But the idea is you take 13 troops in the glider, CG-4As, you could take a Jeep howitzer, 75-millimeter howitzer, or 3,750 pounds load in a glider towed behind a C-47, 20, 30 miles behind enemy lines. Once the glider cuts loose, goes in and lands, the troops jump out. Primarily, the object is a crossroads, a railroad junction, any way that we, when we get behind enemy lines, is to cut off the supplies, resupplies, ammunition, food, replacements to the enemy that's facing our troops.
Right.
So once we cut off their supplies, No ammunition, no food, no water, no recruits, nothing like that. After 3 or 4 or 5 days, you either give up or get shot. That's the idea behind it.
Right. But just so everyone knows, this plane has no power. Once you land it, you're not taking off in it again, and still got to get back to friendly territory because you're behind enemy lines.
When we landed with combat troops, we were a combat troop,
which
I'm going to get into
later.
Okay, I got my orders. When we were flying those high-performance sailplanes in Texas, they have a lot of dried-up little ponds.
Right.
The sun beats down on the ponds. The heat rises back up as the thermal. Mm-hmm. And I'm flying along, and all of a sudden I feel a lift, and I can see there's a thermal. I just circle around, fly up like that, get up to about 3,000 feet.
Because if you stay off above that tunnel of hot air and keep circling, it'll keep elevating your glider.
Sure. Hot air rises. Mm-hmm. You get into the hot air thermal, and you go up with it, get off, fly around again. After a while, the guys down on the field give me the green light. Get back down. Somebody else wants to fly. So I'd go back in and I'd fly down. Okay.
Okay, well, we need to catch our first break. But when we come back, we're going to move from training into flying that first glider mission as part of the massive Normandy invasion in June of 1944. Find photos of Mel then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking today with World War II glider pilot Mel Pliner of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Brooklyn, New York. 15 glider pilots from his squadron were killed during World War II. Before we're done today, we're going to hear just how close Mel came to adding to that number. But for now, Mel, you told us about some of the flight training you had, but there were some other things that they had to teach you guys given the unique and unprecedented nature of what you were about to do.
Once we land, like I told you, we're going to be a foot soldier. So we were sent to a base in Kentucky where they taught us how to throw grenades, how to dig a foxhole, that sort of thing. From there, we were sent to Alliance, Nebraska, where the 436th Troop Carrier Group was being assembled. The cooks and the bakers, the power pilots, the glider pilots, the 436th Troop Carrier Group, which consisted of the 79th, 80th, 81st, and 82nd Squadron and Headquarters.
All right.
After the group was formed, which might have taken a couple of weeks until all the crew came together, we were then transferred over to Laurinburg, Maxton, North Carolina, where there was an airfield there. Now, the power pilots never towed a glider, so they were taught the crew chief how to come forward, tighten up the tow line, and then give the signal. Taken off and on the tow line was no big deal. Like I say, they would be informed to fly. Here's the airfield right here. They would fly along here. We'd get the green light and then red light to cut off. They'd take off with the tow rope, drop the tow rope over there. We would now do a turn, come in and land here. We had made, I don't know how many dead stick landings in the puddle jumpers because we'd get up to 500 feet, turn the switch off, kill the engine, and come in. We had dead stick landing in the puddle jumpers, in the high-performance sailplanes, Waco gliders. Now we're doing it again with transition training. Once we started enough flights and that they felt confident that they knew how to do that. Now we were getting the troops on base that we would carry in the gliders. They would bring their Jeeps and the howitzers and whatever gear to learn how to load that now in the glider and secure it down. Learn how to open the nose of the glider, back a Jeep in, back in a trailer or whatever they were going to carry. Learn how to secure it down. And anytime we carried a Jeep or a howitzer, and that we'd carry three troops. We carried ammo for the howitzer and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Once they'd load that, then we'd take off and ride around, get them feeling how it was to ride in the back of a glider. And there was one time when I had 13 troops, hot summer's day, took off, got in a formation, bouncing around. The guys took their helmets off. They still had the helmet liners on. Their helmet on, like, ah! 13 troops puked in the helmet.
Uh-huh.
When I came in for landing and I hit the brakes, 13 helmets came flying forward. That was a mess. But after a while, I got used to it.
Hopefully they did too.
Well, it wasn't long after our transition training, towards the end of December, the C-47s took off to go to England with their crew. The rest of us, I don't know about the cooks and the bakers stuff that were assigned, but I know the glider pilots, me and 4,000 other guys, got on board the Queen Mary the end of July. And since we were leaving in New York, I had an opportunity to go back home to 368 East 46th Street, where my parents were still, and my sister had just had a baby, Maxine. That was in December of 1943.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to say goodbye to your family, knowing where you were headed?
It wasn't hard, but, you know, I knew I was going overseas. I knew I had a job to do. I was trained for it. I'll keep in touch.
Did you think you were coming back?
Oh, I knew I was.
Did they know what you were going to be doing?
Yeah, I told them I was in a glider program.
What did they think of that?
What could they say? Wish me luck.
Uh-huh. At the time, did you think of it as a dangerous job?
No. I felt confident that in my glider training, hell, I knew I could take off and land and make a good landing.
Mm-hmm.
Any landing you can walk away from is a good landing.
Well, that's the thing.
Really?
And not every one of those for the gliders worked out that way.
During training, I crashed my share of gliders.
Yeah?
We all did.
Sure.
But they were expendable. They were building them. I think there's about four or five different companies that were building the CG-4A gliders. And they had plenty of them.
You haven't mentioned this, but a lot of times I know this happens in war. Did anybody ever give you a nickname?
A nickname?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it?
Crunch.
Now, how in the world could you end up with a nickname like Crunch?
That's what a glider sounds when you wipe it out. It just goes crunch. That's on the back of my A2 jacket, which...
If I'm one of those troops that are getting on your glider and I know your name is Crunch, I don't know if that's reassuring.
Well,
I don't know if I want to fly with you.
They didn't know that.
So you're heading overseas. You're going to England, and
yeah, we're on.
This is going to be real here.
We're on the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
Me and 5,000 of the guys.
Uh-huh.
And what they've done is the holes in the ship, they put in bunks, 1, 2, 3, 4 bunks with a ladder up. But as officers, we had staterooms. And in the staterooms, they had double bunks, one here with a top and another one over here with a top. We got 2 meals a day served to us by servers. 4.5 days across the ocean, zigzagging.
So the subs wouldn't get you?
So the subs were right.
Yeah.
We got the east side of England, got into port. We got there. We got on buses that took us to an airport near the town of Membury. And this is where the 436th Troop Carrier Group was assigned to be. Other groups assigned other air bases all over England. But we were assigned to air base just outside of Membury. More glider were brought on base. And, of course, we did more training. And also there was some English horse gliders that were on base. And I got about 2 hours flight time in one of them. And, you know, it's like if you can drive a Ford, you can get into a Mercury or Oldsmobile or any other car and drive it too.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with gliders. So after 2 hours, just to get the feel of it. Now, the CG-4A glider weighed 3,750 pounds, empty. could carry a load equivalent to its empty weight. A Jeep trailer, 13 troops, 3,750 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
The English horse glider weighed 7,500 pounds, twice as much.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Waco carried 13 troops, the horse could carry 26 troops, had the seating mm-hmm. for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tricycle landing gear type, where the Waco was a tail dragger.
Right.
We compared the two gliders as the horse to a Mack truck, where the Waco was to a sports car.
Although both Mack trucks and sports cars have engines, and you didn't in either one of those.
Well, we were just comparing the two of them, because it was a big old clumsy thing.
Yeah.
Where during training, they could carry, the C-47s could have a double tow. It could pull two gliders. This one would be on a 300-foot tow line. This one would be 7,500 feet behind. And there were times when I would raid the line, and I caught hell for it.
I bet you would.
I do.
That sounds pretty dangerous.
Yeah. Well, not if you know how to fly the damn things. Okay, so we're down in Membury training. Troops coming aboard and so forth and so on. More training. About the first week of June 1944, we could see the things are starting to tighten up on the base. Troops are coming on base, and they're not loading into gliders yet. Come to find out that Eisenhower had planned on D-Day to be the 4th of June.
Right.
But he checked with his weather squad. They told him that the 4th was going to be stormy, but on the 6th, there was going to be a break in the weather. He says, we go on the 6th. Came the 6th, we had guards around the area. They would call the glider pilots into the assembly room, and we were assigned gliders. I was assigned an English horse glider for D+1, the morning of the 7th. But D-Day, the Waco gliders, was a night mission.
Right.
And we lost quite a few gliders and glider pilots. We didn't know this. The next morning, we got up, had our early 6 o'clock in the morning breakfast. We're out on the flight line, and my glider that I'm assigned to is a horse glider on the very end of a 5,000-foot runway. Here's the end of the runway. The tail section is over the grass on the end of the runway.
Getting every inch you can use, huh?
And I got 23 troops in my glider. I don't have 26. Piece of cake. But any of the glider pilots in the head of me that felt they had more troops than they could carry was sending them back to the last glider. I wound up with 33 troops.
And the maximum supposed to be 26?
No, the max, yes, 26.
I hope they were skinny.
I was overloaded.
Uh-huh.
I could do one of two things. When it came time to cut loose, I could cut loose and claim I'm overloaded, jeopardized, and so forth, and justify my abort. Or when it came time to tow off, we're going down a runway, and normally the C-47 is up, gear up, and I'm still on the runway. I do one of two things. Now, it has a little tank, about 6 inches in diameter, maybe a foot long, with 100 pounds pressure, and it operates your flaps and the brakes on the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
I made a check, make sure I got pressure before we even took off. Crew chief made sure those gliders had pressure. We're about halfway down a 5,000-foot runway, C-47 off. Like I said, I could do one of two things. I could abort or drop half flaps, which I did. And we staggered off the runway and caught up to the rest of the formation over the English Channel at 1,000 feet. Now, that's a normal flight elevation until we get close to the landing zone. Then we drop down to 500 feet. Reason being that if you're the lower you are, the more chances you can get shot at, whereas a higher elevation takes longer.
So you're up over the English Channel.
Over the English Channel.
With a powerless airplane that's overloaded.
Right. I'm flying a glider, not an airplane.
Right. There's no engine on this thing, no power,
no.
And you've got more weight than you're supposed to carry.
Right. As we approach the coast, we drop down to 500 feet. Cross the coast of France, and here off to my right, inland, about 20, 25 miles, is the town of St. Mary in Glisse.
Mm-hmm. Very famous in D-Day lore, yeah.
Yeah. I could see it off to my right. We go inland, and I get the green light to red light, and I cut loose. I turned to the right, and here is a field in front of me, trees about 80 feet high. I'm at 500 feet. I come in, and I do a nose-high slip, but I come over the trees. I see cattle down there, and I don't see any dead ones. So right away it tells me no bomb. And by then I have set my air brakes, smooth tires, no tread on them because it's strictly rolling tires, big tires. I sat down on wet grass. I'm still doing about 85, 90 miles an hour, and the hedgerow was coming up pretty damn fast.
Uh-oh.
So I pull back on the wheel as far as I can, and I jammed it forward. Now the lieutenant is standing between the loading compartment and the pilot's compartment on the door like that. I told him before, sit down, Lieutenant, we're going late. Just don't worry about me. I said, okay. I jammed it forward like that, and the glider is made all of wood, mm-hmm. plywood. There's no metal in it.
Right.
The only metal is the landing gear and the nose wheel.
Right.
When I jammed it down like that, the nose wheel came up through the floor, got him right in the crotch.
Ouch.
He fell back.
Oh.
When I did that, I broke the back of the glider like that, and the bottom of the glider started to dig in to the wet grass.
Uh-huh.
I came to a stop with my right wing about 10 feet from the hedgerow. Now, in order to open the cargo door, broke the back, had to get the fire axe off the wall, chopped the door open. We all got out, and they carried him out. I made my way back to the coast, and I remember this. Along the road, I noticed that there was stacks of dead krauts, and they had them stacked like this, like firewood. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Let me ask you about that landing. Had you ever considered that maneuver before, what you did in that moment? I mean, it doesn't sound like something you'd ever practice.
No, I never thought about that.
But you're seeing the hedgerow, and you're thinking, we're going to run fast into that. We're all going to die.
I got to stop that glider somehow.
Because the frame of this glider is so fragile that if you go into that, it's just going to compress everybody
Right? Yes, it would have gotten me. And I don't know how many troops behind me.
So this is never something anyone had told you to do, nothing you had ever
practiced.
It's just
thought,
in the moment.
That's the only way I'm going to stop it.
So you probably saved a lot of lives by doing that.
Absolutely. We all got out okay.
Saved for that moment, but then you're behind enemy lines and you don't know where the enemy is, right?
No, we didn't draw any fire. Didn't draw any fire at all. We all got out.
And how far inland are you?
I would say good 20, 23 miles.
So you got to somehow get from there back to the coast
right.
without getting killed.
Right.
How do you do that?
Cautiously.
Uh-huh.
Very carefully, which I did.
By yourself?
By myself.
What was that like? What'd you do? How did you know where to go and how to get there?
I knew what direction I had to go in. And fortunately, I didn't. I don't know. Maybe the troops had eliminated any enemy in that part.
What did you see along that journey back to the coast?
The krauts all stacked up.
You saw dead Germans. How long did it take before you found American forces, or at least friendly forces?
I was imagining about a day,
uh-huh.
the same day. Of course, when a Jeep was going that way, I'd get a ride in a Jeep.
So this is basically your first day at war.
Right.
You've landed a plane in a way you'd never done before. You survived that, and now you're on your own, half a world away from your family, not knowing where in the world you are. Were you scared at all?
No, I wasn't.
Why not?
I knew what I was doing. I felt confident in the training that I had. I never planned on wrecking the glider to stop, but I figured that was when I was sliding down on wet grass, how else could I do it? The brakes weren't doing any good.
Right.
I couldn't put my foot out to stop it.
And, you know, you mentioned St. Mary Glees, so, I mean, you're in the same territory. I mean, that was a spot where the Americans ran into some German forces, and of course, the paratrooper John Steele was famously hanging from the steeple
have
there.
Have you been there?
No, but I know they still have the parachute hanging there in his honor, right?
Yeah.
And a dummy in it.
Well, when I got a ride,
this
guy was going back to the beach, got on a boat back to England because they had more gliders with resupplies in them.
So that was so much fun, you wanted to do it again.
But they needed more glider pilots. And, you know, if they told me, hey, get in glider number so-and-so, you're hooked up to a C-47, fly back where you were for resupply. But by that time, the seaborne forces had come up, so they didn't need to resupply.
But Mel wasn't done yet. When we come back, we're going to hear about his other glider missions, including the final one that nearly claimed his life. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Mel Pliner of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Brooklyn, New York. We heard about his first mission as a glider pilot as part of the Normandy invasion, and just a couple months later, in August of 1944, he was preparing for another one.
We were flown down to the northern coast of North Africa in a C-54, about 20 other glider pilots and myself. We landed at an air base down there and refueled, and the C-54 then flew up the east coast of Italy to a town of Certavizia.
All right.
Where they had carved out an airstrip, a dirt airstrip, and they had brought in some Waco gliders. Okay. After the Normandy invasion, those of us that survived and flew horse and gliders went to the commanding officer and told him, look, Colonel, we trained in the American Waco gliders. Let the Limeys fly their glider. And we never flew a horse again.
Uh-huh.
And he understood. Now, I'm fortunate that I did fly the horse and glider on D+1, because if I had been assigned a Waco on D-Day, in a night mission, I might not be here.
Very true, because you know what happened to so many of those guys who did.
So many guys. It was a night mission.
Not to mention the guys they were carrying. So many of them were killed, too.
Right.
So you guys now are in Italy, and you're going to be flying
the
CG-4.
We're up to this airstrip near the little town of Certavizia. They bring on more troops, jeeps, jeep trailers, and so forth and so on. We, the glider pilots, and I guess the rest of the cooks and the bakers also, are in a tent area that's just a little bit below the airstrip, and we're sleeping in cots. And one night comes a hell of a rainstorm, and all the rainwater comes down into the tent area. When I wake up in the morning, my B4 bag is floating. Water is right up to the bottom of my cot. Everything else is floating, so there's no point in putting on shoes and socks. We're all walking around barefoot. Did that for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days. Water drained off. Sun came out and dried up the mud. All you could see was footprints in the mud. Okay. Dried up. It got cleaned up, washed out, and so got back to normal. And I was assigned a Waco glider with a 75-millimeter howitzer, 3 troops, 10 rounds of ammunition. Now, reconnaissance photos showed that the town of Lemuy, L-E-M-U-Y, about maybe 25 miles inland from the southern coast of France.
Yeah, so this is the southern France invasion.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Just off to the right, there was a big clump of trees in the formation of the letter C. And when we were briefed, they showed this on the screen. It said, when you see that letter C, that's the area that we want the gliders to land in because we're behind enemy lines.
Of course.
We get into the glider, hooked up, take off, and we start to go north to the coast. And I notice the formation up front does a turn to the right. 15 minutes later, do another turn to the right. I think, well, mission's been aborted, canceled. 15 minutes later, do another turn to the right. Another 15 minutes, take another turn to the right. And the formation now headed back to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Reason being that when we were supposed to land up there, the place was covered with fog. So they had to kill an hour.
An hour later,
yep. We're heading back up. Okay, we get over the coast. I see the big letter C. I see the town of Lamoy. And I get the red light and the green light. And I cut loose. And here, now this is wine country. They're growing grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I see a field. It's a vineyard. And they've got the posts every so often with the wire going on and the grapevines on the wire. I come in and land on the top of this grapevines. And as I'm doing that, I'm just knocking down the posts. But the wire is taking the fabric out from under my glider. Made a good landing. I got out. Three troops get out. Ahead of us and off to the left is a farmhouse. Two stories with shutters. On the bottom, the three windows, the shutters are closed. On the second story, the end shutters are closed. But the middle one is open and it's dark. And we start to draw rifle fire. We can see the fire. Get out, get in the side here. Hot, eating grapes. Wasn't very long after that, another glider comes in and lands between my glider and the house.
Mm-hmm.
13 troops, pilot. They get out, come over on my side. The sergeant in charge says, Lieutenant, we got a bigger gun than they got. Why don't we get it out? That's a good idea. You guys all concentrate on your fire on that middle window. Open the nose. And we roll out the howitzer. The sergeant takes open the breech, bore sights it, gets around, puts it in, closes the breech, and says, anytime, Lieutenant, out come three krauts. They could see that howitzer. We go blow them out of the front. So they decided to give up. About that time, the troops here take over the krauts. All right, I know where the farmhouse was where we flew over, where the troops had taken over and made a headquarters. I figure, well, got to get back there and check in and tell them where my glider is with a howitzer. So I'm walking along this dirt road. I come upon a little Fiat automobile. It's in the ditch. So I figure, well, hell, a glider pilot would rather ride than walk. I'll check this out. Booby traps. So I went over to the field where the paratroopers had landed, took my knife and I cut some shroud lines, went back there and tied the shroud line to the door handle, and I went around the back and I pulled it and opened the door. Nothing happened.
You were bracing for an explosion. It didn't happen.
I was thinking it might be booby trapped.
Sure.
I don't know.
A lot of things were.
Evidently, it wasn't. Door was open. Walked over there and I looked inside. I didn't see any booby traps. So I got inside. It's got the ignition and the keys. It starts right up.
But it's still sideways in the ditch.
I can't get out of the ditch. Along comes Jeep.
Yeah.
I have to stop him. I say, hey, guys, help me get this thing out of the ditch. No problem, Lieutenant. So we hook up a chain, pull it up. They say, now, if you guys would give me about a gallon of gas out of your jerry can, I'd appreciate it. No problem. Put in a gallon of gas. I look at the gauge, half a tank. Now, something like that ought to get at least 30 miles to the gallon. So I drove this thing up to headquarters, told them where my glider was, and I said, I told them I got this little Fiat automobile. You think it'll tow a howitzer? I said, only one way to find out. Well, okay, go back to your glider and bring that howitzer back to headquarters. So I go back to the glider. The three guys are still standing there. I said, okay, guys, let's hook this thing up to this little car. By the time we're bouncing around in sand and pushing it, we finally get it up on the road. The guys get in the car, and we drive up to headquarters. I said, where do you want it? He said, no, just leave it anywhere. So I dropped it there. About that time, other glider pilots had checked in, and they were off to the side somewheres, and they had a pot that was, they were cooking something in. So when I went over there, I said, hey, what's cooking? He said, what do you got to put in it? He said, come with me. In the back of this Fiat, I had found, now, it didn't have a trunk like our cars. You got to pull the back of the back seat forward, case of French wine. With the bottles with the corks on it, the wire over it, you know.
Right, to release it.
Yeah. Look at that. It says, you're in. Well, needless to say, after wait, we passed out.
You had some French wine.
We get up the next morning. Yes, I'd like to go into the town of Lamoy and see what it's like. Well, the town of Lamoy is laid out like a wagon wheel. The hub is the church with the steeple, and the spokes are streets. We drive into the town, and we get about a couple of blocks from the steeple. We start to draw rifle fire, stop the car, and then we get out into the doorways. I said, tell you what, let's concentrate our fire on the bell. Bing, bing, bing. After we've been firing at it for about 3 or 4 minutes, out come two krauts. Can you imagine being up in the tower next to that bell and we're bing, bing, bing. They gave up. Well, when they came down, the town came alive and they were going to kill him. Now I said, no, hold off. Wasn't long after that the seaborne forces had come up from the beach in their trucks and equipment, and jeeps and stuff like that. And they took care of the krauts. We decided to go back to base, to our headquarters, get our gear, and head down to the beach. And I asked the swabby down there who's in charge. He said, Lieutenant over there. I drove up to Lieutenant. I said, Lieutenant, if you get us on the next boat out of here, you can have this car. He says, you see all the cars and trucks against the seawall? All mine. I wasn't the only one. Well, we got on a boat over to the island where C-47s were in different squadrons waiting to take the glider pilots, those that survived. And we waited a while, took us back to our base. Well, we got back to base, and after the glider pilots made it back that survived, and we knew who made it and who didn't, because we knew how many of the glider pilots from our squadron flew in and how many came back. We got back on the C-54 and went back to England. And that was the Southern France invasion. It was shortly after that in September that we were getting ready for another mission. This time it was the Holland mission in September, about the 14th, 15th of September. This time I was assigned a Waco glider. I had a Jeep and three men.
Okay.
For Holland. Got ready to take off, got in line, got in formation, echelon of four to the right, and we flew over to Holland near the town of Eindhoven. Got the green light, red light, cut loose, made a good landing, no problem. Opened the door, Jeep drove off, got a ride up to headquarters, checked in, three other glider pilots, and we got together. We decided to go to the Hotel Metropole. Famous old Metropole. It was the top of the line. By that time, it was hot and sweaty, dusty. We're looking for a room to get up to take a shower, clean up, go see about some nightlife. We got up at this Hotel Metropole. We walk in, up to the desk. Here's a guy with a neck bow tie, tuxedo practically, you know. He said, we'd like a room. We don't have any rooms. Place is deserted. I said, let's fall back. Okay, walk up to the counter, put our rifles on and says, we want a room and we'll pay for it. And we got a room. We get upstairs, take our clothes off. One of the guys on the toilet, and I need to take a leak. But there's another toilet over here. So I sit down on that one and I urinate. And when I flushed it, I got the surprise of my life, a bidet. Anyway, we cleaned up, went down into town, hit a few bars, dance a little bit and so forth. And eventually we made our way back to our base. And that was the Holland invasion.
Well, you had a better time there than a lot of guys did.
Oh, probably.
Because that was really ugly for quite a few folks.
From then, it was shortly after that, that the 4th Division Troop Carrier Group transferred over to France to an air base, A-55, just outside of Fontainebleau, famous church there.
Right.
And more training. There was a wrecked B-26 on the base off the side. When I was assigned my Waco glider, I took some tools and went over there, and I got out a couple of pieces of armor plate.
From the B-26?
Yeah. I put one under my seat and one under my feet in the glider that I was assigned. This time, I have 13 troops, and I was assigned a co-pilot that was a washed-out cadet. He didn't make it in power pilot, so he transferred to the glider program. Mm-hmm. He had about 2 hours flight time. Never been in combat. Came time to take off, and we're waiting in line, and one of the troops fired a rifle. They're holding a rifle like that.
Yeah.
And he pulled the trigger, fired a round. I got out of my seat to check to see if he'd have cut any of my control wires, my control cables. Fortunately, he didn't. I said, "You guys put your rifles on safe, all of you," which they did. Okay. Came time we took off. This time, we're going for the Rhine invasion. Get into formation, of echelon four to right. Okay, we get ready to approach the Rhine River, drop down to 500. As we cross the river, I couldn't see the Weitzel, but before we took off, I was assigned a bazooka, and my co-pilot had a vest, three rockets in front, three rockets behind for the bazooka.
Right.
We were going to land close to a main intersection highway where we were supposed to join other troops to set up a defense to keep any resupplies from getting to the troops
right
in the front line.
Cutting their supply line.
Cross the Rhine, drop down, green light, red light, and I cut loose. And here's a big field, I don't know how many acres, big power lines with the high towers across the field and gliders. Some of them hit the wires. So I figured, well, okay, I cut loose, and I'm heading for that. And I got a place where there's room for me to land my glider. I'm 200 feet high, and I'm holding the wheel like this. And some crowds, a bird shooter. Now, you know, most of the crowds were aiming at the pilot's compartment, and it was going to the tail section. This guy's a bird shooter. You know how you lead birds?
Yeah.
He was a bird shooter. I'm sitting like that, and he gets me right through the arm between the radius and the other.
Still have a scar
see
there?
See that?
Uh-huh.
That's where it came out.
Oh.
I said, "Take over, I'm hit."
So this is your co-pilot who's never done this before.
He froze.
Can't function.
I pull up the spoiler and held it up with my left foot, and I landed it with my left hand and my right foot.
Because your right hand, you can't do anything
with.
My
right hand fell down.
It's useless.
Into shock.
So you're landing this glider one-handed.
One hand and one foot.
And that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a video of Mel explaining that incident and showing you on his arm where he was hit. Unfortunately, we're out of time on today's episode, but we are going to hear a little bit more from Mel next time, and we'll also hear from his daughter as we mark Father's Day weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.